because of so many things are happening with the United States war with Iran and trying to find out how much we're going to expand and what may be coming next. Those are all pertinent questions. But in my view, there is a bigger issue that is not getting anywhere near enough exposure. And it could be far, far more important than just whether there's a war with Iran or how it may get solved, or even the cost of oil. And that is the ramifications of what this war may mean in ways that not very many people are thinking about. But fortunately, there is one person who's thinking about it, and we have him on our show today. We are very delighted to have back again Mike Adams, also known as the Health Ranger, is founder of all Brighton platforms. BrightonVideos.com is where you'll find some of his information there. He's also an AI developer and a number one bestselling author of Food Forensics. Mike, really glad to have you back today.
Thank you, Daniel. It's always great to be on your show. I'm a fan of your work as well, so I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you very much. And it's kind of one of those odd situations where I'm really glad to have you on today, but it's going to be a pretty sobering show here. But we've got some information I think people need to know, because this war has to get over with much more than just what people may think. Just because war itself is bad and needs to be over, especially when it's not having any positive impact. But this one especially is in a much bigger situation here. And just to kind of to set the stage for what we're going to talk about here, probably the two key issues here is, number one, the Strait of Hormuz remains shut. No matter what the, I don't know why they do this to see, U.S. Central Command keeps on posting things. President Trump periodically posts that the Strait is open and traffic is fine. And it never is when you look at what's actually going through. And now that it's even more complicated because the Houthis out in the Yemen and in the Red Sea area have shut off the Bab al-Mandab. And so now then, and they've already attacked Saudi shipping already early in this process, which really underscored that and caused the price of oil to go up. And that got a lot of people's attention. But as something you have published a few days ago got my attention even more than that. This is this article you wrote called "Trump's War on Iran is a War on Global Food Security, and Here's the Math to Prove It." And that that really got my attention here, because the article opens up by saying the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran has effectively closed the Strait of Hormuz, and the mainstream media is treating this as a geopolitical story about oil price and naval posturing. They are missing the real story, the coming famine. So can you just, first of all, tell us what prompted you to write this story, and what do you mean by the coming famine? You didn't write the possible coming famine.
Yeah, it's baked in at this point. So let me just establish a little bit of background in case your viewers don't know my background, known as the Health Ranger. And I run a mass spec food laboratory, a very large lab in Central Texas. I'm the founder, and I'm a published food scientist. And also my company, Health Ranger Store, imports food from all over the world. And then we test it in our own lab. That's kind of what we're known for. But We are very much aware of food supply chains and international providers of food and some of the stresses on the system that are happening right now, delays, crop failures as they occur. We will know about them ahead of everybody else, or I should say ahead of, you know, retail consumers.
Yeah.
So what I, you know, and I'm an AI developer, so I unleashed a bunch of AI agents the other day to do some research on this. And I was asking the question, what percent of the total world fertilizer production actually comes out of the Persian Gulf? Now, if you just consider the seaborne traded fertilizer, that's about 30%. But compared to the total fertilizer of the world, which feeds about 4 billion people, or half the human population, the amount that comes out of the Persian Gulf is, according to my research, from 8 to 12%. So I just went with a 10% number, because that's right in the middle, easy to work with. So if you say that 10% of half the world's population depends on the Strait of Hormuz in order to be able to eat because of the, you know, the fertilizer outputs, which, and we can talk about how nitrogen, how ammonia is produced from the Haber-Bosch process, which uses natural gas for reasons involving chemistry. We can get into that if you want. But the result is that really, 400 million people in the world are at risk of famine because of the continued failure of this war, of Trump's war on Iran. And importantly, Daniel, those 400 million people are largely not located in the United States or Canada or the UK or other typical Western nations. Those 400 million people tend to be located in what we would call the global South. So that represents about 5% of the human population that will be facing food scarcity. And not all 400 million people are suddenly going to have nothing to eat. There will be food redistribution. There will be social pressures. There will be sort of shared famine where a much larger number of people will have a lot less to eat. And the ramifications of this are dire, one of those being mass human migration to the north. So what Trump is actually unleashing, as much as he says he's trying to stop, you know, illegal migration into the United States, he's actually unleashing global conditions that will lead to massive, what Michael Young calls human osmotic pressure. People leaving countries like Bangladesh or India or Yemen or Somalia or maybe even, you know, Egypt in some cases, and countries in Central and South America looking for wealthier nations where they won't starve to death. So we need to talk about, and I think that's why you had me on, we need to talk about what this is going to unleash in terms of the social implications.
Yeah, and I do. I actually want to start with that. You mentioned the Haber-Bosch process, which we have on the screen here, because you say it is not some obscure industrial footnote. It is the single most important chemical reaction for human survival. Can you explain to us a little bit so we have some idea what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. So Haber-Bosch describes a process where you take atmospheric nitrogen. And remember, the atmosphere is about 79% nitrogen, but it's bound up tightly as N2. So it's nitrogen and nitrogen. And plants ordinarily can't access that nitrogen from the air because it's bound up. So you have to separate the nitrogen and you have to form a nitrogen compound, which is ammonia. NH3 is one of the easiest to produce from this process. But in order to do that, you have to subject atmospheric nitrogen to hundreds of atmospheres of pressure and extremely high heat. And the only way to do that is to use an abundant economical form of energy, such as natural gas. So gas that comes out of the Persian Gulf, or previously that came out of Russia and went into Germany before the Nord Stream pipelines were destroyed, the German company BASF, BASF, used to manufacture a large volume of ammonia and then downstream products such as urea or various nitrogenous fertilizers. And the gas that comes out of the Gulf, some of that gas is consumed right there in the Haber-Bosch process in the various facilities that surround the Persian Gulf region in order to export things like ammonia or urea or nitrogenous fertilizers, which is a completely separate path from phosphate-based fertilizers, which uses sulfuric acid that comes out of the oil. We could talk about that separately. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is our world today has built an infrastructure over the last, let's say, 70 years or so that supports the feeding of 8 billion people, whereas about half of those 8 billion people are only able to eat because of Haber-Bosch. So that's why it's the single most important chemical process that keeps humanity alive as we know it today.
And I wanted to ask you about that. So how long has that been in effect? Because my understanding is that the only reason we can have 8 billion people is because prior to this, the food supply wouldn't support that many people. So that was one of the reasons there weren't more. But now that we have it, we can support more, but only as long as we have it. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So if the infrastructure of creating synthetic fertilizers shrinks or contracts, then the world population will have to contract to reach homeostasis with the available infrastructure. Now, before Haber-Bosch, which, you know, they were German scientists, and I think it was around the 1917 or so, and then there was development over a few decades. But this came out of German innovation, World War I and World War II era, okay? And the German scientists, I mean, you know, Berlin was the centerpiece of scientific genius in many areas, chemistry and physics at the time. And this process was necessary because the world was running out of fertilizer, because before that they were literally scraping like bird poop off of islands to feed the British people, you know, I mean, to fertilize the crops to feed the British people. Or they were using manure, right? So you can take a lot of farmland and you can use horse manure and what have you, cow manure, you know, it's a messy business, but you can grow some amount of food, but you can't grow enough food to feed 8 billion people. So if we have to go back to the animal manure days or the bird poop days, and pretty much most of the bird poop was already harvested, taken off the islands, then our world population may only support 2 billion people, maybe 4 billion if we're lucky, right? And that's why it's said that synthetic fertilizer feeds half the world's population. That's a pretty conservative number. Some other economists would say, no, we're going to collapse down to 2 billion. So
help people understand, because if soldiers who are not scientists in this arena may think, well, hang on. I mean, okay, so you don't have as many fertilizers. We'll use something else. But we have the farmland, and we can still keep growing stuff on the farmland. But you're saying it's not a matter of the acreage that you can farm, but it's this other thing. How does that manifest physically on a crop?
Well, yeah, right. It's the acreage will only produce crops based on the inputs, especially when that same land has been used for many, many years. It doesn't have any natural fertilizer in it anymore. And, you know, you have to add the inputs, N, P, and K, right? But, you know, if you go back to ancient Egypt or, you know, Roman times, et cetera, like the River Nile, they depended on the flooding of the river to bring fresh nutrients in. And then you would have record crops the year after the flood. So flooding was a natural process to redistribute trace minerals as well as nitrogen and phosphorus compounds. That was, you know, natural fertilizer. If you didn't have the flood, you didn't have the crop yields. Same thing is true today, except we've built a population that needs enough food, you know, that needs synthetic fertilizers in order to function. So if the Persian Gulf stops functioning, we lose about 10% of the global fertilizer production, which puts, like I said, about 5% of the current human population at extreme risk of food scarcity.
Now, that leads into one of the next points you make in here is the delayed time bomb. So whereas with oil and the price of oil, as we saw during the time of the signing of the MOU in June, is it had an immediate reaction, and the price of oil dropped actually precipitously, probably more than the fundamentals would allow. But nevertheless, it did that. But you're saying that this is not that way, and that this is the delayed time bomb to 2027 and 28 will be catastrophic. Can you explain why that is?
Yes, because of growing and harvesting seasons, and the fact that right now in America, for example, we are eating food that was planted last year in many cases. Some of it was grown and harvested last year in 2025. Some of it's being harvested now from the spring crops, and in the spring here in North America, most farmers were able to get the fertilizer they wanted because the war wasn't, you know, we were just barely into the war at that time in the February, March, April planting seasons in North America. The shortages hadn't yet really kicked in. But all of that changes in the fall for the Northern Hemisphere. And you look at crop planting seasons from Europe, Middle East, Southeast Asia, China, Russia, you know, North America. The planting seasons are, you know, different depending on your geography and climate. But the fall planting seasons are going to be especially difficult. Fertilizer prices are much higher, and fertilizer scarcity will be a factor. Now, I'm not saying that the whole world's going to starve. I've been very clear. There's going to be about 5% of the world's population that will essentially have no access to food. But I'm not saying it's 100%. It's 5%. But the pressures from that will not be felt until the result of the fall planting season and the harvest that follow, which in some countries, the harvest begin in like November or December. But in 2027 is when things really kick off. That's when we're going to really see the shortages. And Daniel, the thing that's going to make it far worse is that diesel scarcity will be a factor in North America at the same time. So you're going to have much higher diesel prices, and transportation is a major cost component of food and farming and agriculture. I mean, I own tractors. I live on a ranch. Those tractors burn diesel, you know, a lot of diesel. They're just gulping diesel all day long. If that diesel price goes up, food prices go up. That doesn't even consider transportation. That's just a farming operation. So North Americans aren't going to be facing mass starvation. They're not going to be eating each other like cannibals, but they're going to face much higher prices in the grocery stores and much lower supply, which means less choice and shelves that aren't stocked as deeply as they are today. That's what we'll face in America.
And let's keep it on America for the moment. if the war magically ends tomorrow and the strait starts to open back up, the Bab el-Mandab opens up, there's no evidence that's going to happen. So whatever this day happens will be some hypothetical place later into the future. But let's say that it did. If that's the case, how much trouble of the kind you're talking about in North America is already baked in, and how much will this opening now relieve that?
One growing season, roughly, is already baked in. So what are we, 5 months into the war, give or take? So roughly, that's one growing season. That's already baked in. It's already done. We will face food scarcity. We will face food inflation. We will face a fertilizer crisis, no matter what. If this continues for another, let's say, 6 months or to the end of this year, that's when things become really catastrophic on a global basis. So, you know, think about it. Societies can, they can redistribute a certain amount of food for a period of time. But you can't lose calories forever and keep all the people alive. At some point, you begin to suffer, you know, so much famine and die-offs, immune systems are compromised, etc. That's going to start appearing in 2027. So my prediction is that you'll see, you know, the IMF or the UN or food aid organizations really putting out the call for emergency food supplies, emergency fundraising, beginning in the spring of 2027. And throughout the summer of 27, one of the main stories that we will be seeing, no doubt you'll be covering it, is the food panic in these other countries and the mass human migration that that's setting off, which is going to create all kinds of, you know, cost pressures and societal pressures across Western Europe, for example, or even in the United States, because there's going to be this massive migration wave from the South.
Where do you project the, because you say only 5% of the population, and people are thinking, okay, it's a big globe, 8 billion people, but you're saying it's not generally dispersed around the globe, but it's going to be localized in some places that are especially vulnerable, which I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's where this migration would originate from. Where are those countries that you're most concerned about?
Yeah, you're correct. So some of those countries are Bangladesh, India to some extent. I mentioned Somalia, Nigeria, Yemen, and in Central and South America, especially in South America, there are countries where there's already a lot of food scarcity pressure. And if you look at, you know, like UN organizations right now or the WHO, they will tell you right now where there are countries that are on the edge. For example, every year Somalia has, you know, millions of people on the edge of starvation, and without food aid, those people wouldn't make it in a normal year. In 2027, that pressure is going to be so much worse that I'm not even sure that there's enough international food aid to go around, because, you know, think about the United States. We're going to be suffering reduced crop yields, not mass starvation, but there's not going to be this great abundance of low-cost crops to just send to the rest of the world. You know, what will be the political will and the economic will of the Trump administration to save people in Somalia with extra food supplies? You know, probably that's not at the top of the White House list, I would imagine. So the saving of people with food supplies, even if you think China might step in and try to help people that are hungry in, you know, Pakistan or India or wherever, well, China can't grow enough food to feed its own people in a normal year either. China imports a massive amount of soybeans and rice and whatever and wheat from the rest of the world. So there's no giant strategic food reserve like there's a strategic petroleum reserve that can take us through 2027, 2028. It doesn't exist. There are small food reserves, but just like the oil reserves, they're beginning to be drawn down and they're going to run out.
And so with these countries where it's going to be, they're going to be the hardest hit, because there's not going to be, I mean, we're going to be already in a scarcity time and of a high price. So we're not going to have a lot of extra to send out. Presumably that's going to be the case in Europe as well. What you mentioned earlier that you have some concerns about migration, forced migration. What is that going to look like? And I mean, we'll just start off here in the United States, because obviously that's a big, huge political hot potato right now about ICE and all that kind of stuff. What is going to happen if you add to it by people coming in even more than they had before?
Well, there will be just a massive amount of pressure. Wherever famine gets very bad, then people will voluntarily leave to seek survival in what they perceive as a wealthier country, which tends to be countries more to the north. So there will be people in the Middle East. Well, let's start with Africa. People are going to, you know, sail across, and they're going to go right into Morocco and Spain, and, you know, ultimately Italy and Greece and wherever. You know, the European, right now, a lot of European countries are concerned about, you know, so-called invasions from sub-Saharan Africa or parts of the Middle East. That's going to be so much worse because of the famine. And then, you know, what about hungry people in India? You know, the government currently subsidizes fertilizer across India to make food affordable. It's very difficult to feed 1.3 billion people, or maybe that number is higher now, especially in a global scarcity scenario. So you're going to see migration. You're going to see people trying to, even Southeast Asia, they may try to get into China, where they perceive there's more food in China. Russia is actually relatively well positioned compared to most other countries, because Russia is more self-reliant and self-contained. Russia has its own fertilizer or phosphate production, and it has its own very mature agricultural system. Plus, the Russian people have a mindset of preparedness and, you know, being ready for harsh winters in much of Russia, obviously. So Russia's probably going to be the best in all of this. The United States is going to suffer a lot of migration pressure, and there's going to be a lot of domestic unhappiness because of the unaffordability of food for Americans who vote. So one of the things that I think is going to hit the GOP very sharply, not just in the coming midterms, but probably in 2028, is that Trump will be blamed, I think, for causing these global conditions that make food unaffordable, and also energy and fuel much more expensive for those who can afford it. So there's quite a social backlash coming in America.
And what about China? You talked about Russia. What would China, you've talked a little bit about India too. They're obviously quite large. How are they going to be stacked up, since they're a definite net importer of all petroleum products? How does that work on their agriculture?
Well, China has a lot of foresight. So, of course, they have massive petroleum reserves. They have been drawing those down, but they're nowhere near emergency levels like we're approaching in the United States. Same thing with food. So China has stockpiled a massive amount of wheat and soy and rice, and they will be eating into those supplies. China's probably better positioned than almost any other country other than Russia in order to survive this. But eventually, China will either have to pay higher prices to outbid food supplies from countries that are producing it. And that's going to get difficult because the energy shock will reduce yields, and the fertilizer shock will reduce yields in countries that are net producers and exporters of food. And on top of that, the United States, you know, China depends on the U.S. for a lot of food exports, and all of those crops and crop yields are going to be affected in the U.S. as well. So China, of course, has a top-down control system. China's not known for having, you know, grassroots riots. China's not going to have probably, you know, an angry popular revolt or anything like that. But they will spread the suffering if necessary across the people, and the people will endure. So, you know, China's going to make it through, but a lot of Western countries may face social upheaval.
Yeah, that's my prediction. A lot of these ways we've been operating, and the expectation and the sense of entitlement that we've had, I think, is not going to do well for us when scarcity hits just by itself. I feel yes. we're going to learn that.
If you don't mind pointing out, Daniel, the fact that food will become more scarce and far more expensive makes home food production much more lucrative. Whereas before, when people would home garden, you know, you could spend a fortune. You could grow the world's most expensive tomatoes, right, that were way more expensive than what you could buy in the grocery store. But all of these factors that you and I are discussing are going to turn that upside down. And there will be a resurgence of, you know, victory gardens, as we used to talk about in this country back in the World War II era. Victory gardens, which decentralization.
Let's just go ahead and get to it now, since we're talking about, there's some other things I'm about to talk about. But I know one of the things that I guess one of your companies do, or one of your services, is that you help people figure out how can they ride these things out, and whether it's emergency supplies or whatever, what can from now, if people recognize what's coming, maybe even in a year from now, already baked in, much less if the war goes on through the end of the year, what can people do right now to ride this out more effectively later?
Okay, sure. Well, and if you don't mind, my main video site is brightvideos.com. That's where people can follow me, and I put a lot of how-to information there. But one of the main things people can do is start composting today, because compost, I call it black gold. Compost needs to age. You need the microbiological activity. That is actually food potential. So if you can, you know, compost kitchen scraps or whatever, and start building a compost pile, you'll need it in 2027 because it'll help you grow more effectively. The second thing you can do is you can actually go to a feed store right now and you can purchase fertilizer. It's more expensive than it was 6 months ago, but you can still get it. And 6 months later, you may not be able to get it at all, right?
Any price, yeah.
So stockpile fertilizer, not so much that they think you're Timothy McVeigh, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah, you do want to avoid that.
Yeah, but enough that you can explain, this is for food production, right? Because that's kind of a, if you could say, a white gold, right? A white gold, because most of the nitrogen fertilizer is white in color, pelletized. That's like a battery for food production, and that's going to have tremendous value in the days ahead. And then, of course, you need garden seeds that are heirloom seeds. You know, I always recommend non-GMO heirloom seeds so you can save the seeds generation after generation. The thing is, Daniel, you know, we all come from our pioneering parents and grandparents and great-grandparents who lived this. They did this all the time. And we need to remember that knowledge. We need to remember what our grandparents taught us. And that's going to be life-saving knowledge right now, because you don't need to grow all your own food to survive this. But if you could supplement your food with 20% of things you grow yourself, you'll save a fortune compared to what food is going to cost in the grocery store. And you'll also have higher nutritional density, which will improve your health. And plus, you know, gardening, it's good for your health to, you know, get your hands in the dirt, get outside, and grow some food. It's a healthy
activity. Well, you are, after all, the health ranger. So,
yes.
That's good
advice. Yeah, and I grow some of my own food as well. I encourage everybody to do that. And there's also a whole area of harvesting wild foods, because there's so many wild foods that grow around. And I'm not even talking about hunting. Some people will do that. But just harvesting wild foods, like on my ranch in Texas, we have wild hogs that are digging up wild onions all the time. But I've also got acorns. And if you know how to just harvest and treat acorns, you have to get the tannins out, which is a simple process, then you can make acorn pancakes. You can have acorn flour and acorn pancakes. I know how to live off the land more than most people, and there are other experts who know more than I do. So we won't starve. But
and are
not everybody has
this on your site somewhere?
Yeah.
If anybody wants to know how to do those.
Oh, yeah. I mean, These are common themes that I talk. I guess I don't have one video in particular that focuses on it, but these are the themes that I cover on a regular basis at brightvideos.com.
Very good.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah, Gary's showing it on the screen right there. Okay. So let's go back to your article here, because this is a separate issue that I think is really important. The moral reckoning. This is a war against the human race. It's not simply a war against Iran, you have written. It's a war against the world's most vulnerable populations who have no stake in this conflict.
Right.
The question is not whether this famine will happen. It's whether we will allow it to happen. Trump's actions risk killing more innocents than any conflict since World War II, simply because the math does not lie. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. So thank you for bringing this up. The moral component here really needs to be considered for history. The number of people who could die from this conflict could actually exceed the Holocaust of World War II. And importantly, and that is if it continues, right? If this conflict ends tomorrow, it's not going to be that bad. But if it continues, it could easily exceed that. We could be looking at tens of millions of deaths over the next couple of years from famine alone. And the majority of those deaths will occur outside the region of the war. So we're not talking about even Iranians dying or Americans or Israelis dying in these numbers. We're talking about people in Bangladesh. We're talking about Africans dying. We're talking about Somalians dying, right? Or South Americans. And this is something that I don't think the White House is sufficiently considering, right? They have their very narrow focus, like, we can't let Iran have nuclear weapons. Well, okay, but is it worth killing 30 million people who live somewhere else around the world for you to try to achieve that goal, which is probably not achievable anyway? The cost of this is in human lives outside the battle zone. And it's not America's bombs that will kill the most people. It's the lack of food. And almost no one's talking about that. So that's why I'm really glad you're having me on, because this is a critical, this is a humanitarian question at this point. This war is a war against humanity.
Right. Yeah. And that is why, when I saw your article, that's why I felt that it was really important, because there are second and third order effects that just hardly anybody besides you and a couple of others you mentioned a second ago were talking about. And we need to get this word out there so that people understand the urgency of getting this war over with.
Yes.
And that kind of led into your last part here, which you said you wrote in just earlier this month. The global population of more than 8 billion people depends on a fragile web of natural gas, oil, and downstream chemistry that took 60-plus years to build. If we lose 25% of these critical inputs, the system collapses. The only path to avoid this famine is to end the war and reopen the Strait of Hormuz, and then, therefore, now the Bab al-Mandab immediately. Nothing else will work. That's what really kind of stood out to me, is that if we keep going on 25% of these critical inputs, the system collapses. Explain how that works, because one may think, okay, well, 25% is terrible, but that means 75% is fine. And how does the whole system collapse if that 25% goes down?
Well, because of the reliance on things like sulfuric acid for creating phosphate fertilizers, right? So, of course, the sour crude oil that comes out of places like Saudi Arabia and Iran, the sulfur is removed during processing. That sulfur becomes the feedstock input to create sulfuric acid. Sulfuric acid is used to pull the phosphorus out of phosphate rock ore. That phosphorus goes into the agriculture industry. By the way, there's another pipeline where high-grade, high-purity phosphorus goes into lithium iron phosphate batteries, or LFP batteries, that are powering, you know, the power grid, a grid shifting from wind and solar technology. So my point is, if you lose the oil, you lose the sulfur. You lose the sulfur, you lose the sulfuric acid abundance. You lose that, you lose phosphate fertilizer abundance, and so on. So these things begin to stack up. And by the way, if you lose the Red Sea, and I know you've covered this, Daniel, if you lose the Red Sea, you lose something like 60% of global shipping of these elements. If they take an alternate route, then you add, you know, another 3 or 4 weeks to the time, and then you have another delay in the system. So the system, see, we are living on a just-in-time global system of food and fertilizer and natural gas and sulfuric acid and oil, and these things are intertwined in a way that creates a just-in-time system where the average human being can't live more than 45 days without food. So what happens if you have a 50-day gap? That person's dead. See, you know, you can't just tell humans, just wait 180 days. You know, the food's coming after the war's over. Just sit around and fast for 6 months. You know, that's not going to work, right? So we are fragile beings in a world of interdependency that is being fractured by this war. And on top of that, it's, in my opinion, it's a senseless effort for the U.S. to try to seize control over the Strait of Hormuz because of geography. You know, God gave the Strait of Hormuz to Iran. You know, I mean, bombing to try to take the Strait back is like trying to go to war against geography, and that's just not going to work.
It is not, and we are proving that it's not. And it's always been insane when Trump said, "Oh, I'm just going to take over this, and I'm going to charge 20% fee." That was always fantasy, because
we're
thousands of miles away and they're on it. But and obviously that happened. I mean, that didn't happen because it became evident within days. And so you don't hear or hadn't heard him talk about that for more time. Listen, this is really important, because it sounds to me like, by the way, if I can understand from what you've said, this just-in-time system, this very intricate system that keeps 8 billion people alive, works okay if there's no war. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. It works okay if the Suez Canal is open, Strait of Hormuz is open. The Strait of Malacca is open. Strait of Gibraltar is open. And the Panama Canal is open. And if everything's working, right, then we're fine. And that's the normalcy bias that people are now living on. And they're assuming that the future is going to be like the past because that's all they've experienced. I can assure you, and you've had experts on like Dr. Chris Martinson who confirmed this, I can assure you the future will not be like 2025. It's not even a prediction. It's a projection of what has already happened. Okay. So this crisis has already happened. Now it's just working its way through the supply chain. And it's a 5-month problem right now. It's survivable. It's not the end of the world. If we get to peace now, if this becomes a 10-month problem or a 2-year problem, then the situation becomes catastrophic. Not just for the economics and industry of human civilization, but for the survival of the total human population as it exists today. And I don't want to have to come on your show, Daniel, and talk about why we've lost 100 million people, because that would be a travesty and it's completely avoidable.
And that's why this last part, the only path to avoid this famine is to end the war and reopen the straits. Nothing else will work. And so it doesn't matter almost any of these other geopolitical things or arrogance and egos of various leaders. It matters to get the strait open so the system can get back in. And it's going to take some time. And what is your estimate, by the way, that say that rational thought recurrence to a lot of these people? They recognize this. Maybe they watched your show here recently. They read one of your articles. They said, oh, crap, we better get this thing over with right now. And Monday morning, the thing is over with. Everybody opens up all their straits and passageways, et cetera. How long do you project that it would take the system to unwind and get back into where it was functioning the way it was on the 27th of February?
Well, it would be way beyond the end of this calendar year. No question about it. I actually don't think that we will ever see the Persian Gulf return to the same outflows that we had in January of this year. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I mean, just some of the oil wells will never produce the same flow that they previously did. And then, shipping insurance. What about ship crews? Who's going to sign up? Yeah, sign me up. I'm going to get on a ship and go into the Persian Gulf when there might be a peace agreement. Who's going to do that, right? I don't think, I'm not trying to black pill everybody here, but I don't think it ever returns to what it was. Will there be some flows out of it? Yes, absolutely. Does Qatar have an incentive to get all of its natural gas production trains back online? Yes. But even they said that's a 3 to 5 year timeline to repair the two trains that were destroyed. 3 to 5 years, Daniel. And that right now, that's a 17% loss of their natural gas production.
That's a big hit.
So, that's in their press release. Okay. So these aren't numbers that I'm making up. And again, Dr. Martinson can give you even more detail about oil and some of the other experts you've had on. And you have a lot of great experts who are on and who are desperately calling for peace for some of the same reasons that we're talking about here today. This is no longer a war between 2 or 3 nations. This is a war for humanity. I mean, all of humanity is at some level of risk because of this ongoing conflict. And in my opinion, Trump and Hegseth need to leave the region. Find a way to declare victory. Some people will buy it anyway. It doesn't matter. Just declare victory. Leave. Let the strait open. Let Iran charge, an environmental fee of $1 million a ship. At least we won't lose tens of millions of people.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I've been arguing really from the beginning of this war, that the walkaway plan, as we call it, even now, as ugly as it would be politically, for President Trump, is for mankind is desperately needed. They can play whatever they want with word games, but we got to get this stuff physically open so that these vulnerable people themselves don't suffer harm and then cause cascading effects for America and Western Europe, where they're going to go if they can't eat. I mean, it's not hard to figure that out.
You understand this because you're a good person, Daniel, and you have compassion for fellow human beings. And, I've watched your show for a long time. And what I share with you is that we have a fundamental love for fellow human beings. We don't hold in our hearts some automatic hatred towards people because of their religion or because of their nationality. We don't just hate Russians for being Russian. We don't just hate Chinese for being Chinese. We don't hate practitioners of Islam for practicing Islam. We believe that all human beings have a right to exist and have a right to access food. Indeed. And we understand that scarcity is artificially engineered.
Right.
Whereas God and Mother Nature give us this natural abundance, but humankind comes along and interferes with it, and then humanity pays the price.
And boy, I appreciate you coming on today, and we will support all of your work because we're definitely working in tandem on that one so that we can avoid some of these worst outcomes. And God help us if we keep going, especially like you said, even like beyond this summer, there's going to be some real problems here. But well, now we know what they are.
Thank you for the invite. Always an honor to join you.
Well, I appreciate it, and we'll look forward to seeing you back soon. I hope it's not for the bad reasons that you mentioned a minute ago.
No kidding.
But our audience here loves your show and loves your work anyway, so I'm sure we'll have you back soon anyway. Thank you very much, sir. And we'll see you next time. We'll see you all on the next Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.